Morning, saints.
Morning,
brother. Right, another year. A new topic. Yeah, you'll be in Matthew for about 3 more years, if not longer. Yeah. No, we finished Elijah last year, character study, so I actually wanted to stay in the Old Testament again. So what I've chosen is I want to do Israel's journey through the wilderness, a study of from Egypt to Canaan. So there's plenty of good stuff in there that can relate to us. So yeah, Israel's journey. The church in the wilderness, which which isn't a good topic, but because the life of Christ really is the life of Canaan. But as we know, our lives are, we have times of victory and we have times of failure. And ours is a journey. It's not always the Canaan life, but that's what we're pressing on to, that the life of Christ would be made manifest in our lives. But just like the nation of Israel in the wilderness, they had failings and lots of moanings and groanings and more failings, and God was faithful to them despite that. So there's lots of stuff in there. But first of all, I want to look at really just what Paul brings out in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Just one scripture really before we get into there. He says in 1 Corinthians 10, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, and they all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." Verse 6, "Now these things became our examples." And then if you go down to verse 11, "Now all of these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall." So what Paul is bringing out here in the New Testament, that everything that happened to Israel is actually written for us. What happened to them is an example of whatever happened in their life is an example for us to actually learn from. It's written for us and for our admonition. So the same failings and the same weaknesses that they had back then, Paul is saying, have a look at them, because they're actually there so that you can grow in your faith and understand the character and the nature of God. So the New Testament always explains the Old Testament. So with that in view, let's go and have a look at Exodus chapter 13. I was a little bit, where do I start with this? Do I start in Egypt when they were with Pharaoh and all of that? But I thought, oh no, I'll start after, when they're on their way out. So Exodus chapter 13, and we'll start in verse 17. So up to this point, that God had judged the nation of Egypt. There had been 10 judgments upon them, the last one being the worst, which was, remember, they had to apply the blood of the lamb over the doorposts, and the angel of death came in and killed the firstborn of every living thing. But because of the blood of the lamb that was shed upon the doorposts, the Israelites were actually freed. And that, there's a great picture of salvation, that the blood of the Lamb is actually sprinkled over your hearts and over your life. It speaks of the new birth that has come in, that you're protected, you're under the Lamb's blood. So it all speaks of salvation. So you've got a picture here of a nation that's just come into salvation and they're on their way out. Okay? So you get to verse 17 and it says, "Then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. And the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you and shall carry up my bones from here. So they took their journey from Succoth and camped at Etham at the edge of the wilderness. Actually, we'll just read 21 and 22. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and by night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. So they've just come out of Egypt. Now, the direct route was to actually go north across the top of the land toward Canaan. But that was the way of the Philistines. And God here, he said to them, look, I'm not actually going to lead you that way. And he said, because you'll get discouraged. You'll have to enter into war with the Philistines, and that's actually not my plan for you first up. So they were not actually ready for war. And it's like that with a new Christian. When someone just gets saved, they're not actually ready to take up the sword. And God knows that. I remember just after I first got saved, I remember, you know, with all the excitement of coming into a relationship with Christ, I was sitting down at the park at Coolum Park with running my dog, and two carloads of Jehovah's Witness came and pulled up either side of me. And I'd only been a believer probably a week or something like that, and I had five of them on me, and I was just sitting on the bonnet of my car, you know, and they just, you know how they go with the scriptures. They just led me on this journey from the beginning to the end, and I knew there was an element of truth in what they were saying, but I had no way to actually combat it, you know, and they just absolutely bamboozled me. And I remember when I was thinking of this, God knew that if he had led the nation straight into battle, they just actually weren't ready for it, you know. They'd just seen all those miracles, but they weren't ready to take up the sword. And it was a little bit like that for me. I was just hammered, you know. I had no answers to any of the things that they said. I knew that something wasn't right in what they were saying, so I actually had to go away and learn these things. But God, he had a completely different plan for the nation. And instead of going north, he actually went south. He went the other way. And we see in verse 21 and 22 that his presence was actually before them by cloud, and it was actually behind them with a fire. So his presence was leading them and guiding them the whole way. There was no map or guide book. In the wilderness journey, there was only one that was actually going to lead them as a nation, and that was God. And when you read Numbers chapter 9, it talks about, you know, that it actually gives, in Numbers chapter 9, 15 to 23, if anyone's writing that down to have a look at it later, it says that about the cloud, there was to be certain times, if the cloud stood for a certain amount of time above the tabernacle, they would sit. If it remained only a certain amount of time, then they would know to move. And it was continuous through the wilderness journey. So you get this picture that they weren't doing their own thing. They were completely dependent upon God's presence to actually guide them. And it's exactly the same for us as Christians, that we need to be reliant upon the Lord, that he is before us and behind us and with us. His presence is continually with us. But we need to continually look to him to actually be the one who has actually taken us on this journey. We don't know how long the journey is, but he is our guide and he is our light. So for them, that's the way it was. So the direct route was north. That was the quickest way. But God had other plans, and he actually led them south. And when you get to chapter 14, it starts and it says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before," I've got no idea what that word is, "between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land, the wilderness has closed them in." Some Bibles will say they are entrapped. And this is always, when you see,
hemmed in,
that's right. So instead of God taking them on a direct route out of Egypt toward Canaan, he actually turned them around backwards and they came down south so that they were actually trapped. Now, This, when you look at Pharaoh, he is a picture. He's a picture of a few things. He's a picture of those that hates the people of God. So in that sense, he's a picture of someone who wants to enslave and entrap and pursue. So he is a picture of Satan and his ways, that he will not let those go who have come into relationship with God. His whole purpose is to actually ensnare you or bewilder you or entrap you or hem you in so that you're trapped, you know. He's also a picture, Egypt is also a picture of the world and its pull and its snare upon the nation of Israel. So God led them to a place where they're trapped. And you've got to ask the question, well, why? Why would God lead the nation, instead of a direct route north, they would have to fight on their way, but he's led them south so that the mountains are on one side, the army is coming down from the other, and they've got the sea on the other side. There's no way out. And I don't know about you, has God ever led any of you guys into a place like that, where there actually doesn't seem to be any escape? And quite often God does. He will lead us into those areas where we think there is actually no way out. Just like he did for the children of Israel. And they would have known when they got the instructions from Moses to turn south, they would have been questioning why, because they would have known that they were going to be boxed in. So this, he led them to a place that was going to be, that they were going to be trapped. So you've got a twofold trial going on here. The first is that God is actually going to judge Pharaoh in the nation of Egypt. The trial really is coming for Pharaoh's way. He doesn't know it, but it's coming for him. It's a final judgment upon him as someone that continues to pursue and enslave the nation. And you've also got a trial of faith for the nation of Israel. It's going to be their first trial of faith. They've come out into a relationship with God, and this is their first trial that they're going to have to undergo. So, verse 4, then I'll harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I'll gain honour over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people. And they said, why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariot and took his people with them. Also, he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and all the chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and they overtook them camping by the sea, by Pi-Hereth, before Baal Zephon. Then we get to verse 10. Now when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. So here's the first, they've come out. Remember, when they come out with truckloads of gifts. All of the riches of Egypt were actually heaped upon the nation. Everything would have been going dandy. It says further on that they came out with boldness, you know, in verse 8. So you've got a picture here of a nation that is high. God has freed them. They've come out. And here comes the first trial of faith. They know that they're trapped, and they look behind and they see something lurking in the shadows. It's coming to get them, and it's the whole nation of Egypt. And their first response is fear. And they're afraid. You would have thought that after seeing 10 judgments upon the nation, and especially that last one, that there would have been a sense of faith in God, that God knew what he was doing. But you know that we are exactly the same. You can have the mercies of God fall on you one day. You can have miracles fall on you one day. And then the next minute, you're afraid of a scenario. You're afraid of a situation. You know? Elijah. Eh?
Elijah.
Yeah, Elijah. Elijah, that's right.
They cried out to the Lord, though, for them.
Yep. So at least, they cried to Moses and the Lord. But their first response was actually fear. And I was thinking, the other day I took Jack out fishing, and I was Jack and one of his mates, and we were in the harbour there, and his mate hadn't done much fishing, so the fishing was quite good. We were getting a few snapper, and Jack's buddy was reeling the snapper in, and then up out of the depths come this big grey-brown mass, and it was actually a bronze whaler chasing the snapper up that we had caught. And he came right up to it and nudged in, and he was swimming around the surface. And the kids that I had Jack on one side, and this other boy was reeling it in here. He was like, what do I do? Because this thing was pretty big, you know, as bronzies are. You know, he would have been 1.5 meter, 2 meters long, probably. Like most, there's quite a lot in the harbour at the moment. It's about 3.5. So one of the kids, the kid that had the rod, was, what do I do? Because he could see this big thing coming after his fish. And they would have been meter wendy away from the back of the boat where the bronzy was. And so I just said, get that snapper in as quick as you could, because he was playing with it on the surface. Now, Jack on my right, he was getting really scared. And he was backing up in the boat and trying to get up and under the cockpit, because he's actually really scared of sharks. And yeah, but he was getting really panicky. You're inside a boat, but it reminded me of this little scenario. The children of Israel have come out, and everything's good, just like the kids on the boat. They were pulling up a snapper. There was heaps of joy because this boy was bringing up a snapper. Then suddenly, out of the depths, lurks this thing, you know, and the nation would have been the same, you know. They come out real good, then all of a sudden, in the background, they see the Egyptian army coming, and you turn from joy to fear in an instant. And Jack was like that. He was really scared. He was scared about what the shark in the water could actually do. There's actually an ending to the story when we get to the end, which is but. What's that? Yeah, he's not here today. Yeah. I'll tell you the end of the story, seeing as we're on it. A week later, okay, so Jack's really worried about sharks, even though we're inside a boat. He's really worried. And it might not be the biggest boat in the world, but he's still worried. A week later, we go out again because.
Did you get the snapper?
Yes, we got the snapper. Yeah.
And the bronzy went away.
And the bronzy didn't get it. Yeah. He just played with it on the surface. But they're pinching them. They're hitting them all the time. We had other ones that were taken, bringing them in. Poof, gone.
You might be in a kayak out there fishing at the moment. Yeah. Yeah,
so, okay, a week later we go out there again. And I got a friend that he was in his boat next to us, and he's all geared up, and he likes catching bronze whalers. So when we were snapper fishing, and he's like about 30 or 40 feet away from us, and we're talking, and then he throws out a whole bonito because he wants to catch the bronzy. So we're there, and he hooks it up, and he probably fought it for about, I don't know, 3/4 of an hour, and went over toward Motorhaw, and he phoned me on my cell phone. Yep, we've got it. Come on over. So we went over, and he had it up on the beach there. So that was all good. So we brought it up right up into the shallows, and you know, it was probably about 150 kg or something, you know. So Jack got to touch it and got to hang on. We had him on the leader, so he got to hang on to that, and the thing was thrashing around and all that. So we got that out, and he just let it go again. Because it was just really, they catch it for the sport of catching it. Because it's the thrill of the fight. But anyway, so we get back in the boat, and Jack says to me, I'm not scared of sharks anymore. I'm not scared of bronze whalers anymore. And I said, why, you know? And he said, well, I've touched it, I've seen it right up in the shallows, I've held it, they don't scare me anymore. And I didn't ask him about it. But it made me think, when you get to a scenario like this, like God backs them into a corner, okay? And his whole purpose is that God's glory and his character be made manifest, okay? So his whole purpose for Israel was that he would show himself to be great. He would show himself to be powerful. He would show himself to be the one who was in control before them and behind them. You know? And that was his whole purpose for the nation of Israel, that they would learn to trust that those things that had dominated them did not actually have to dominate them. That fear actually didn't have to rule, you know? And it was reminded me when he said it to me, when he saw that shark in a certain way, like when you get to the end of the story, the nation of Israel see all the Egyptians dead on the shore, you know? That God was all powerful over their enemy, over the things that were trying to dominate them. And when Jack saw that shark for what it was, up in the shallows and not as much a threat as what he perceived it to be, things changed in his mind. And I believe that God is always putting us into situations for that very thing. He'll bring about scenarios in our life. He'll back us into corners for that very reason, you know, that his glory and his greatness would actually come out. But anyway, I've jumped to the end of the story. We'll get there. Okay, so I'll just read out Psalm 106. It gives a little insight into what the nation was going through in their brains here. Psalm 106, verse 7 to 12. It says, "Our fathers in Egypt did not understand your wonders, and they did not remember the multitude of your mercies, but they rebelled by the sea, the Red Sea. Nevertheless, he saved them for his name's sake, that he might make his mighty power known. He rebuked the Red Sea also, and it dried up, and he led them through the depths as through the wilderness, and he saved them from the hand of him who hated them, and he redeemed them from the hand of the enemy." So it starts off, the writer of the psalm just gives a little insight, and it says that when they were in Egypt, they didn't understand his wonders. They didn't understand the purpose behind them. They didn't understand what God was actually trying to do. And they did not remember his mercies, it says, but it says they rebelled. So God saw their act of fear actually as rebellion, because it was unbelief. It wasn't faith. They'd come out, but the first little trial of faith they had failed in. But he nevertheless he saved them for his name's sake, it says, from the one who hated them and wanted to pursue them. Okay, so just that writer there gives you a little insight into what was going on with the nation. So then we get, okay, we finish verse 10. Verse 11, "Then they said to Moses, 'Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, "Let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness.'" That there's just the language of unbelief and fear. The first time something happens, they blame Moses and they say, "Look, we just don't need this trouble. We would have been better back there. As hard as it was back there," they're saying, we would have rather been back there. Did you bring us out here to die?" You know? And then you get to verse 13. And Moses says to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, for which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. Fear not and stand still." What does it mean to stand still? Because there's a couple of little principles here that God is trying to teach us. In the situation of when you're hemmed in and entrapped, backed into a corner, Moses' directions here is what God actually wants us to actually learn in the situation. The first thing is stand still. So what does it mean to stand still?
Surrender.
Yep, surrender's a part. What does surrender mean?
Well, cease striving and trust God.
Yeah, so you don't panic, you don't flee, you don't run, you don't try and sort the situation out yourself, which is what we normally try and do. If there's anything that we can do, we'll try and sort it out, you know. But for the nation, they were hemmed in, you know. there was actually not a lot they could do. But yeah, stand still. It means those very things. It means give the situation first and foremost completely into the hands of God. It means don't try and work it out yourself, but expose the scenario into God's hands. So, because really, for God's glory to be made manifest, self must get out of the way. Self must get out of the way. And your attempts to fix a situation must get out of the way first for God to actually act. And that's one of the hardest parts. Because if there's something that we can do, we'll do it. You know? But God is saying here, the first thing that you need to do is stand still. In other words, expose the scenario to God and get out of the way. Allow him into that situation first. It means to rest. It means to have faith in one that can actually work on your behalf. This is all the things that standing still actually mean. A really good illustration of standing still is, you probably all know that part of that scripture of Jehoshaphat. You know, when the armies are going to come. It's in 2 Chronicles 20, if anyone wants to have a look at that. All these nations are bearing down on him, and the first thing he does is he goes and lies before God. The threat comes, we're going to just come and wipe you out, you know. And he lies down before God and just tells God what they've said. They've said this and they're going to do this. And then the prophet comes to him and virtually mimics this whole passage and says to him, you don't have to fight here. God's going to act on your behalf. I want you to stand still on top of the hill and see the salvation of God. You just hold your place and God is actually going to fight on your behalf today. And you've got the same sort of principles through here. The first thing they had to do was stand still. But interesting, when I was looking about this, the next part they had to do was see the salvation of God. So it's, what it means is that you've actually got to be looking for God to actually do something. It's one thing to stand still, take a place of rest in him, but you've actually got to be looking to what God is going to do for you. Stand still and see the salvation of God. So it means an actual active looking toward what God will do in that situation. So in verse 14 it says, the Lord will fight for you and you shall hold your peace. And the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? So obviously this is what Moses was expressing, what the nation were doing. Tell the children of Israel to go forward. So you've got these three principles. You've got, when you're hemmed in, the first thing you need to do is really get yourself out of the way. Stand still, rest in God, expose the situation to him and look toward what he's doing. But then the next thing he actually instructs them to do is to actually go forward. Be active in this. And when I was thinking about it, I thought there's actually a really good illustration just in a few chapters, which we'll get to. Do you remember when? Who was the first army that actually attacked them when they went into the wilderness? Amalek. That's right. Who was actually a really good picture of the flesh trying to dominate. But we'll get to that in Exodus 17 when we get there. But you've got a picture here of what's Moses doing? Can you remember? He's in that scenario. He's standing on top of the hill, or actually he's sitting on top of the hill, and he's in a picture of standing still. He's resting. He's in an attitude of worship and complete surrender, as Sheila said, to the Lord. What's his servant doing? Yeah. He's got two people either side of him helping him, but he's got Joshua down on the battleground with the sword in his hand going forward in the battle. So you've got this picture here of standing still in God and his servant Joshua going forward with the sword in his hand. You got the two aspects of these things, and they were dependent upon each other. Remember when Moses' hands come down, the battle started to go the other way. So they kept him in an attitude of rest and surrender toward God. And when he did that, Joshua, the battle was going his way. But you've got this thing of resting in God and going forward. So you've got that picture. So the Red Sea is for us in the New Testament, what does the Red Sea sort of represent? Yeah. Yeah, it represents baptism. In the same way that Egypt was buried in the Red Sea, Romans 6, best chapter, one of the best chapters in the New Testament, talks about that we also have been buried with Christ in baptism. He took us, he took our fleshly nature so that thing that pursues us doesn't have to actually dominate, you know. It's been buried and we've come out the other side risen in Christ so that we have a new life. That old doesn't have to. Egypt and its power has been buried in baptism. This is what the New Testament speaks about the Red Sea typologically. So, yeah. So in verse 16, but lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. If any of you guys have got maps in your Bible, there's they're actually not sure about where Moses actually crossed. And a lot of maps show different things, and they're unsure about the different places, where is Marah and where is Elam. As an alternative view, have you guys heard of a guy called Ron White? He's an American archaeologist, and he believes he found the place. And I just clicked this. Anyone see this? Most of your maps in your Bible say that the crossing was somewhere in here, the Gulf of Suez. Okay? Now, Ron White believes that, you know, they camped at Succoth up here at the top. He's found evidence that the crossing was in this Gulf of Aqaba, that they came down into here. Okay? If you want to look him up on the internet, there's some really interesting things. He's a Christian archaeologist who has found lots of things. And in this area of the Gulf of Aqaba, he found there's a beach where they would have encamped before Egypt came against them, big enough to, you got about 2 million people they came out. They reckon it was at least 2 million people that came out. There's a beach there large enough to hold them. They found a natural shelf across this gulf. It's about 3,000 feet deep either side of this natural shelf. They found a pillar either side that was erected by Solomon. Solomon believed that was the crossing site. And you can see it all on the internet. There's these big, huge pillars that Solomon had erected and dedicated because of the Red Sea crossing. They found, when they dived in this area, they found chariot wheels, horse bones, Egyptian swords, all that sort of stuff through this natural shelf. On the other side, he believes, is where he considers Mount Sinai to be. Your traditional Bible views thinks that Mount Sinai is down here in the Sinai Peninsula. But he believes it's actually over in here in Arabia. And the only verse in the New Testament that actually says where Sinai is in Galatians, where Paul actually says Mount Sinai in Arabia. He actually says it. But the traditional view is that it's in here somewhere. But he's been into this area around these mountains, and the whole place is closed off by the Saudis, and you can't get near it, and like most things. But it's different. So it's a traditional, it's a different view. Most people believe that the crossing was in here. This guy believes it was actually in here, that they came over the top. The way of the Philistines is to go up there along the top, but he believes they came down here. So, but it's something to look at as a different view anyway. Okay, so verse 18, then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gained honour for myself over Pharaoh and his chariots and his horsemen. And the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and a pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that they did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So in other words, he caused the wind to part and the waters were like a wall either side and they went through. I don't know about you, but if you'd been crossing, you reckon you could have resisted putting your finger in the wall? And if you'd pulled it out, who caused the leak? You know, that would have been really hard, especially for kids. I don't know, if I was walking through there, I would have loved to have just, could you put your finger in it, you know? Yeah. You'd be running. Yeah, be the quick march. Yeah. Yeah. So they went through on dry ground. Now it came to and the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all of Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of the fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. Not about you, but if I was in that army, I don't know whether I would have gone in. I would have looked at it and said, I don't know about this one, boys. this looks a bit dodgy. They're soldiers. They're told what to do. Yeah, they don't have an opinion, I suppose. That's right. But out of all the miracles that you would have seen, you would have thought, oh, yeah. Don't know. But it came about in the morning watch. The morning watch is between 2 and 6 a.m. So the Egyptians went in there in the middle of the night. So whether they knew where they were going, it would have been dark for them, but it was light for the Israelites. But they pursued them at the middle of the night. And it says that he looked down upon them and he troubled the army and he took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty.
They had no spears.
Yeah. Took off their chariot wheels and the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. And then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea and the waters may come back upon the Egyptians and on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. You got a complete judgment. All of them were consumed by it. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land into the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on the left. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. So the whole purpose is that God's glory would be made manifest. Now the liberal says about this passage that the shelf was only about 6 inches high. That's how they could get across. Well, if that's the case, how did the whole army of the Egyptians drown? Did they all lie down and suck up all the water so that all their lungs were full? But no, and Israel saw he saw them all dead on the seashore. So yeah, so this was a trial, twofold trial, one against Pharaoh and Egypt, but also it was a trial of faith for the Egyptians, that God would be shown to be, the Israelites, that God would be shown to be seen as the one who protects them, the one who leads them, the one who guides them, and that his glory would be made manifest. So, is there any other thoughts? I know there's actually quite a lot of verses through there. Is there any other thoughts through that lot of passages?
I never knew that they were going through at night, actually.
Yeah, the morning watch.
I got a note in my Bible that says the morning watch, it says from 2 a.m. to dawn.
2 to 6, that's right.
That would have been really scary, eh?
Yeah.
Like if they had no light.
Well, they said they had a cloud behind them, you know. So they had light in front of the Israelites, and it was darkness in behind. So whether they whether they went into there ignorantly or who knows.
Total judgment, don't they? Everyone.
Well, that's consistent with the sinful nature that we've got has been totally buried in its baptism with Christ. Totally. The sin nature has been totally dealt with. So yeah, it had to be total. Yeah.
It was a deliverance,
right? Yeah. Or it's Satan's power is completely
judged. It was a deliverance. And the
judged,
soul is cut,
you know?
It's there in
yeah.
15.
Yeah.
Yep, I know.
No, it's all good. Good to have opinion. Well, they sing a great big song after this. You know, Miriam gets out there with the tambourine and cha-cha-cha-cha, and then it's... Then it's straight back into another one, you know. But it's yeah. But that's what it's like for us too, you know.